second speaker today is Forbes Moorlock. Forbes is a lecturer at Syracuse University here in London. Forbes has published widely on hospitality, friendship, seduction, and the uncanny, as well as the writing of Derrida, Rancière, and Freud. In 2009, he published Freud and the Gift of Flowers with the artist Sharon Kidland. He has taught at Syracuse University for more than 20 years. Forbes.
Sorry, I'm not going to be nearly as entertaining as Michael in his very dry way. Or witty, shall I say. No. I've already started badly. But it's going to be, as those of you who read the book, it takes a long time to get going. I mean, most of the book is a set of introductions and starts. So I want to start somewhere else with the words of Derrida. The outside does not begin at the point where what we now call the psychic and the physical meet, but at the point where the mnemi, instead of being present to itself and its life as a movement of truth, is supplanted by the archive, evicted by a sign of rememoration or of commemoration. The space of writing, the space as writing, is opened up by the violent movement of the surrogation in the difference between mnemi and hypomnesis. The outside is already within the work of memory. Now, I suspect that sounds a little bit familiar, but it's not from archive fever. Those of you who read archive fever will recognize that the terms arrest that. In fact, their sentences, the last sentence that is almost directly quoted in archive fever, is from 26 years earlier. It's from Plato's Pharmacy. So already this idea of the archive of hypomnesis and anamnesis, or the mnemi, is in play. Okay, and it seems it's also in play today, because actually anamnesis is the living memory, the recollection, as opposed to hypomnesis, which is, this is all from Plato's Phaedrus, which is the written record. And in a sense, all of you and all of us are here because somehow we have a desire for the living memory. The written record of the event is not enough. There's something about that in a sense, Derrida was already there. But I know you're here for living memories, and I guess I should give mine very quickly, which is that I do remember. I remember René Major introducing the whole thing mysteriously by saying at the beginning there was going to be, Derrida was billed for an hour and a quarter, there was going to be an extra session at the end of the day. On the one hand, that was a bonus, but on the other hand, after a long day, you sort of thought you were looking forward to the pub, and now we have this extra session, and he wouldn't initially tell us who it was. And it wasn't until later in the day that he announced that it would be Jacques Derrida again. Okay, who would be, after it had a break, would be continuing. Okay, so that was the first one. The second thing I guess I remember is, people have described it as the clarity of his presentation. I would say rather it was very easy to follow. In other words, we were listening for, and someone will tell you to the minute how many hours it was, but there was no way that anyone followed every moment of that and could concentrate for all of it, but it was extremely well signposted in the way that Derrida had great facility for, so that if you lose yourself in your own thoughts for 15 minutes, you inevitably were brought back to, oh, this is where we were, now I know where we are, we're going on. And I do want to say it was to be present there, not because it was Derrida speaking, but because the actual content of the lecture, it was immensely exciting. It was hugely exciting because we didn't know where it was going. And I would say, every time I read Archive Fever since as a text, I've never got that same thrill, that same pleasure. To me, in some ways, it seems, now that I know it, an unbalanced work. Okay. But in the beginning, it was very exciting to see where it was going. There remains it. And I took notes. So this is my hypomnesis, because I knew I wouldn't remember. Okay. Notes in which I note just that Archive Fever was not Archive Fever, it was Archive Sickness. Okay, and in which archaeology was in fact archivology. Now, you may say the last one, the difference isn't very significant, archaeology, archivology. Neither name's a discipline. Insofar as Derrida talks about general archaeology, it's a bit like grammatology. It's a non-discipline discipline. It's an impossible science, if you like. Okay. But it is interesting, it seems to me, that the archaeology brings back the viol, the vial of violate and violence, which it seems to me is absolutely key to his understanding of the archive drive. And also I would say, it seems to me, if archaeology names a discipline that didn't exist 20 years ago, in a weird kind of way, I suspect why many of you are here today, is because it does exist by another name today, and it's the academic discipline of curating. Many of you are from curatorial backgrounds, and certainly Guy's impetus is from curating. And so I'm sort of interested in the sense in which today is really about a discipline trying, in a sense, to do exactly, to get in touch with its own beginnings. In other words, to revisit one of its founding texts. Okay? And in fact, I mean, the Arche of the archive, in a sense, and one of its founding texts being, of course, a text that begins with the Arche of the archive, which would be Archive Fever. Okay. Ivan asked me to do one thing, and I said I was going to do something else. So very quickly, here are the two things. One of which is to locate Derrida's text in Derrida's thinking, which anyone who ever reads any Derrida will know is an impossible task and one no one should ever attempt, okay, and a fairly worthless task. And the second one is, I do want to say something briefly about the address of the lecture. So very quickly, we can, Plato's, I'm just going to list some texts. They'll be familiar to some of you, don't worry if they're not. Plato's Pharmacy, 1968. Before that, we could say the very famous essay from 1966, Freud in the Scene of Writing, which is Derrida's first encounter, published in Writing and Difference, really first encounter with Freud as a writer. Okay. But I also want to say, in a sense, the encounter with Freud as a writer and with Freud predates that in The House of Derrida, because The House of Derrida, exactly as he reminds us, the House of Freud, includes a psychoanalyst, which is that Derrida's wife, Marguerite, is an analyst, or was an analyst. And in 1966, exactly the same year that Freud and the Scene of Writing is published, she's publishing a collection of Melanie Klein's writings in French in her own translation, to which Nicholas Abraham, some of you will know the name, wrote the introduction. So there's that in terms of there. I would then say Nicholas Abraham is also in the picture in terms of, there's nothing in the text that I can hear direct echoes of the text Faux, which is the introduction to The Wolfman's Magic Word, except for the whole notion of the secret, which is key to, it seems to me, allied to and first thought through that notion of the crypt. And it's also, I suspect, where Derrida is first interrogating what it means to be a friend of psychoanalysis. Postcard, postal technology, au revoir, okay? I mean, just a whole set of references there, beyond psychoanalysis. A magic number to me, which is improbably brief, okay? Telepathy. Beyond psychoanalysis, I would say Spectres of Marx is the last text he wrote before this one, so the ghost and the messianic are there. Okay, Politics of Friendship will be the next book, and it's there in The Band of Brothers. And most significantly, the text, it seems to me, is the 1991 text Sur Confession. Okay, it's in the book that he does with Jeff Bennington called Jacques Derrida. Okay, two books published in 1991. Okay, both of them have Rembrandt engravings in them, Rembrandt's Jewish subjects. One, as we know, is Yerushalmi's Freud's Moses. Okay. It's published in exactly the same year as Derrida's Moses book. Okay. But Moses, in this case, in the case of Sur Confession, is Jacques Derrida's dead brother, Paul Moïse Derrida, okay, named for his maternal grandfather, okay, Moïse Derrida, okay, of course named for the Moses. And this is the book, in a sense, in which where Freud negotiates in 1991 most clearly with his Jewishness, okay, with his own family, with his own circumcision, and with the fact, among other things, that he didn't have a son circumcised. Its core is a book that he was never published, that he never completed, the Livre d'Elie, stuff that was done in the 70s, notes on a big book on circumcision that was never finished, okay, the notes that predate Envoi. Okay. And he says, and you'll get the reference to this immediately, he says at one point, this is a book in which he dreamt of after the death of his father in 1970. In other words, this was to be the big book that was being his interpretation of dreams. So, got it. Very quickly, if you beg your indulgence, okay, just three addresses very quickly, one of which is that the book is, this is a lecture is addressed to Yerushalmi. Okay, it's dedicated to him, it's dedicated to Freud's sons and to Freud's father. Okay, through a very clear identification with Yerushalmi. In other words, these guys are playing sons of Freud. And for all of his understanding of Yerushalmi's rhetoric, he's acting and acting the same thing in his own position as a son of Freud. And the thing could be read as a battle of brothers. It is a fratricidal text. Okay, and it's actually a bloody good one in terms of doing in your brother. Okay, it seems to me hugely effective as that. Second address is, Yerushalmi was there as the guest of René Major and Elisabeth Rudnesko, the Société Internationale d'Histoire de la Psychiatrie et de la Psychanalyse. And here I want to underline in all of that, histoire. Second address, and this is where I think it's very dangerous to be a friend of Derrida's because of his notion of friendship, is the identification of a historian. In other words, Yerushalmi says he may not know and be able to define what it is to be Jewish, he may not be able to define what it is to be science, as in psychoanalysis being or not a Jewish science, but he has no problems at all identifying himself as a historian. And he's a historian who will not deal with what Freud calls, in the very book he's looking at Moses and monotheism, the historical truth. He's only interested in the material truth. he will not take on that historical truth. And that, it seems to me, is there's a huge address in that into the very discipline of history. Okay, and Yaroshalmi is a practitioner of that. The last address, then, is, and this is where I want to just observe, is to the Freud Museum. An address, for example, 24 Merrifield Gardens. But not only that. Okay. I mean, he's exemplary here in the way he treats the Freud Museum, what it is, its institution, its location, all the rest of that. Freud's house. Okay. And also, and all the things that can mean, including the house of Freud. So a place of work, a domicile, a family, a lineage, as in the house of Atreus, etc., etc. All of those things are in play here. I just want to say that the last address, then, is to the Freud Museum, okay, which has the liberty, I mean, of not being the Sigmund Freud archives. In other words, that was the point at which it was, although it was, we just heard the connection with the archives. In a sense, it was pretending it didn't have an archive. I want to say something about this. The Freud Museum is still a home, okay, a custodian, if not of a curator, okay, and it's not just a building. In other words, this is what's interesting to me about the Freud Museum. We're here. In the auspices, we're here in the Freud Museum, and yet it's something else as well. And I want to say that full credit to three people for this, the wonderful polyvalence of this and the richness of this, which I think Derrida identifies so clearly without yet knowing that it's true at the beginning of the lecture, which is Michael Molnar, Ivan Ward, and Erica Davies. Okay. I would say that the reason the Freud Museum is the wonderful place that they made it is because, despite what Michael said, they didn't know what a museum was supposed to be. And that is entirely to their credit, okay? In other words, it became, because one of the things it became is an institution that was open to the future. What was to come in exactly the way Derrida articulates, which is what most museums are not and cannot be and will not be, okay? And one of the futures that it was open to, and I want to thank the three of them enormously for this, was to the future of archive people.